The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast, and I am really excited because we have Greg Stoneberg today. And Greg is a really unique person in the sense that he's not so unique in his investing, because we've had a lot of people on the show that have done some amazing things, and we've gotten some comments saying, but you know, I don't want to open a business, or I don't want to go buy 90 rental units. You know, I'm just kind of an everyday person. Can I still make this work? And Greg actually has done all the right things over time without having to do anything crazy. And so I'm very happy to have him on the podcast this morning. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks so much. Glad to be here. In all honesty, and just knowing Tanya now for about a year and a half, Tanya is the one who gets me to do crazy things, like buy a rental property that I've never seen before and stuff like that. But no, thanks very much, Tanya. I appreciate it. With about 18 years of government service, joining the federal government, the Department of Defense, literally right after college. At the time, my college girlfriend, now my wife, literally, we graduated, packed up a U-Haul 2 weeks later, and I was working for the federal government after graduation. So I've been with the federal government now for long enough where I kind of know the different ins and outs of all the different accounts that we do, all the different the TSPs, the IRAs. And kind of all those benefits of federal government life. And honestly, I don't like finance. I don't necessarily understand it. I don't really know the stock market, but just with some simple research and you know, reaching out to people in the know, I've kind of established a pretty strong base of a financial portfolio. And I just, like Tanya said, you know, listening to all these amazing stories of my colleagues makes me kind of feel not ashamed, but just wondering how they find time to do all these things when it's hard enough just to kind of live your life. But I guess the point of this is really that even with just some basic knowledge and some dedication and flexibility, that you can, as Tanya says, your wealth.
Achieve big things.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, it's
yes.
The embassy wealth. And I like the concept of sometimes wealth moves beyond finances and reaching other goals. So I'm happy to talk to Tanya about all of those things today.
And I like the fact, Greg, that you've focused on the wealth piece, because wealth is a lot broader, right? Because money is good for the good that it can do. And just having a bunch of money and nothing else in life isn't really the goal, right? I mean, money allows you to, you know, be more, do more, not just have more, right? So, I think for our listeners, it's going to be interesting because I got your bio, because I do ask the people that we interview on the podcast to send a little bio, and I'm going to read you a little piece of it because I think it's kind of fun what Greg has here. He says, so Greg Stoneberg has acquired more three-character abbreviation accounts than he knows what to do with, from TSP to IRA to HSA to 529. Learning about each of these growth vehicles is daunting, and committing to them is even scarier, especially for someone like Greg who, well, self-proclaimed does not understand the stock market, nor does he really care to. That would make two of us, Greg, by the way. And over time, he and his wife have figured out their own path to financial stability and quote-unquote wealth. Leave no doubt, mistakes were made, then corrected, maybe made again. Despite being a single-income family for over a decade, they have dipped their toes into real estate investing, self-financed and international adoption, traveled extensively, and are on track to be TSP millionaires. Ultimately, their story shows that the opportunity to grow your wealth and spend it coexists and doesn't require sticking to just one plan. I absolutely love that bio because, again, the path is not one size fits all, right? And we've heard from a lot of different people about what they're doing to grow their wealth and to live bigger, better lives for their families. And I think everybody's story is unique. So, Greg, tell us a little bit about how you got started. I mean, you're saying that, you know, you weren't into personal finance. You didn't really understand the stock market. So how are you on track to be a TSP millionaire?
So, I mean, first, again, I think a couple of things. Again, I understand that not everybody has, everyone's got a different path and everyone starts from a different starting point. And I think, you know, one thing we struggle with, especially people in the federal government who aren't used to working with businesses and salary negotiations and things like that, they're always a little hesitant to talk about money, talk about where we're at. Mm-hmm. And I myself am too. And I think I've been talking to Tanya for almost since about her third or fourth podcast episode about doing this. And I finally decided, okay, I have enough. I have enough guts to come out and talk about this stuff. But to answer your question, I mean, for me, it was, like I said, I seem pretty confident in a lot of things I do, but it's very hard for me to make decisions sometimes. But one of the easiest things to do when starting the federal government was that, you know, TSP, well, start saving for retirement. And, you know, when you show up at 22 years old and your first day of work, you're signing life insurance forms, you're signing health insurance forms, right, and they're asking you about your retirement fund, you kind of take a step back and you realize where your life is changing. And but making those early commitments, I think, really helps. And two of the things that really helped me, honestly, I'll say, is my father. And I think, and that's, we'll get to that in a little bit in the podcast about helping set up your future, or it's not just your future, it's your family's future. So, you know, my father, who, you know, doesn't hold a 4-year degree, worked, you know, in restaurant management, worked in selling vacuums door to door, and eventually started selling, you know, what was an insurance agent for a successful insurance agent for 25 plus years, basically told me from day one is put in what you can into your retirement fund, start early, and you'll never miss that money. And it's one of those things where it was like every promotion, every cost of living adjustment, put a little bit more in. Eventually you'll hit that max, but you'll never miss it because you've never seen it. So it is that set it and forget it mentality. So that was one of the first things. And I always did that. And when I started in 2004, you know, the TSP limits, it wasn't, it was percentage based, actually. I don't think you couldn't do as much back then, but even then, starting out on a GS-8 salary living in a 1-bedroom apartment in the courthouse area, you know, we didn't have the money to put it all in right away. So again, just starting mm-hmm. it early on, and with every promotion, and back then promotions came pretty quickly. And you know, there was a hiring surge and there was a talent gap, and they were looking, where I was working, particularly with the Department of Defense, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, they were really looking at keeping the talent that they acquired. So promotions came pretty fast. So as those increased, so did my TSP. So that was the first thing. And the second thing to get me started was just simple research. Money Magazine, Money 101, Money MSN, you know, reading up on, you know, simple index, you know, investing in the stock market via index funds, low, you know, Vanguard. Obviously, everyone always talks about Vanguard. But those types of things really helped. And then lastly, some people live and die by a budget. And early on in my career, you know, again, my wife and I, we set a budget. We did the best we could to live on it. Sometimes we went over and sometimes we didn't, but we understood what those risks were. So those were kind of the things. And lastly, and I know this is a difficult conversation to have with a lot of people when you talk about it, but, you know, we limited our debt. We really did. I was fortunate enough to come out of undergrad without any student loans, attended a state university. My wife did as well. We went to college together, and she came out with a minimal amount. She came out with under $20,000 in loans, and we were able to pay that down, and we paid extra towards that. So again, limiting our debt, and I know that's not a possibility for everybody, especially when you start out. It's very hard to start out without any debt like that, but again, sometimes those are choices you make, private university versus public university. So those are really the three key things was using resources, whether it's a father, a friend of a friend, simple research and trusting in some of those easy things that are proven, and then also looking at limiting your debt.
There's a lot there to unpack, actually. Can we go back to, you know, your father telling you with the TSP, hey, when you start, just put aside a little bit. Was that hard to do? Were you a saver before you started making, you know, federal government money? Because I find that, you know, saving is a habit. And if you don't have that early on, it's very difficult to do. And I think I really like your point about how when you start something new in this case, right, like it's easy to say, okay, I'm just going to set it and forget it, because you aren't used to the money, right? So that's a really easy way of, like, even if you aren't a really good saver, to just, okay, well, I'm just going to take the, you know, 5%, 10%, whatever it is, and then just not even think about it, right? So, I mean, were you a saver before you got your job?
Well, I guess that's kind of hard to say, simply because who really saves that much in college? I mean, for me, and again,
fair point, fair. What is there to save, right? I mean, you're not making much to begin with.
Exactly. But yeah, but I do think there's another mentality there of making choices. And, you know, my wife and I always kind of kid that, you know, we choose carefully what we spend our money on. We, you know, I wouldn't call us frugal. I wouldn't call us thrifty, but, you know, we choose Kindles over iPads. We choose Mazdas over Mercedes. And things like that. So starting out young, like, yeah, I name dropped, you know, a one bedroom apartment in Courthouse back in 2004. Well, you know,
fancy,
yeah, but it was a one bedroom Courthouse apartment that was a 15-minute walk to the metro, not above the metro, right? And, you know, I think at the time we were driving a 96 Chevy Lumina that my parents gifted me. So again, a car that was already, you know, 8 to 10 years old. That actually didn't last very long, and that's a sore point with my wife. but you know, things like that, where, you know, our biggest expense at the time was the most expensive free dog that we ever adopted from a shelter, right? So, you know, we made those choices, and, you know, those emergency room visits when the 9-pound dog eats a 1-pound bar of dark chocolate on Christmas Eve.
Oh,
you know,
dear.
Those kinds of things add up, and those kinds of things is what makes it difficult to save. But again, I think it's a mindset of making those choices where you choose what you spend your money on, and you take that vacation, or you have that fancy dinner, or you buy those fancy clothes, but ultimately you can't have it all, especially at that age. And I think we realized that early on, but we also said, with a government job and in my mentality, almost from day one, I kind of knew I was going to work for the federal government for the majority of my mm-hmm. career, if not all of my career. And it was something I always planned on doing, even from a young age. The direction has changed here and there, but I think the stability of a federal job helps you realize that you can, you know, those growth vehicles are there for you. And you, the earlier you take advantage of them, you know, compounding interest just kind of takes off after that.
And that's really, I think, some really good tips for kind of our sort of entry level government, you know, employees that are listening, because much like you, when I started in the Foreign Service, like I had a lot of student debt. Actually, you didn't have a lot of student debt, but, you know, I had the debt, but I had the old car, and I was a decent saver, because again, when you don't have much, it's easy to save in a way, because, you know, your financial situation is pretty simple, right? So if you can get into good habits, then as you go along, you know, it gets easier, right? So, and I take your point about, you know, Kindles versus iPads and Mazdas versus Mercedes, because I think that is the key at the beginning, is to be really smart about keeping your costs low. And it just happens to be usually at a time of your life, I'm thinking, like, you know, 20s, for example, when probably saving for retirement is not the first thing on your mind, right? And I think that is the key time to put some away. And not that you can't have fun, but have some of it earmarked, right? Like you were saying, like your father was telling you, to either TSP or, you know, some other kind of investment vehicle. I'm curious, when you signed up for the TSP, what percentage were you putting in there? Were you maxing it out from day one? Were you just getting the match? How did you do that?
No, I was doing a little bit more than the match at the time. I wasn't able to max it. So again, at that time, when we were looking at like a GS-8 salary, which was about $37,000 a year, mm-hmm. you know, $2,004. And plus at the time, my wife, you know, she came down without a job. She wanted to go to DC with me. We decided to make a go of it. So right when we started, I'd say probably for at least the first year and a half or two, it was more than the match. I remember that. But again, cost of living adjustment goes up, promotions come, and you start putting more in. And when she found employment, she had access to a 401k. So we had to make those decisions on paying down her debt versus the 401k. But yeah, I think, you know, taking a look, it was probably more than the average, again, GS-8, you know, employee was going to put away. And, you know, even then it was just, you know, looking at which funds, simple funds, the life cycle funds were something rather new at that time. And I wasn't, I wasn't putting into that. I was looking primarily at S Fund and C Fund. And again, so this was, you know, by the time things got rolling, it was 2005, and it was a fast 3 years before the crash of 2008. And, you know, things were rolling along. And then, you know, 2008 comes, and, you know, and just, I always kind of have this in the back of my mind. And just for the podcast, I actually went back and look. If you go into TSB's website, if you ever want to track yourself, you can go back. For me, they had my annual statements from 2007 up until today.
They do.
You know, even for, you know, somebody who'd only been saving for a few years, you know, come 2008, I had a negative 41% drop in my TSB savings for the year. Yeah.
And you were in the life cycle funds at that point?
No, at that point I wasn't. I wasn't doing life cycle funds. I was primarily in the S and the C. And I think I didn't have any in the GNF at that point. And that's part of the story I wanted to talk about when we talk about quote unquote mistakes were made. You know, I didn't, for all the talk we've just did about me kind of having the long view of things, I was still a novice quote unquote investor, and it was all kind of new to me. And I got pretty rattled, obviously, because, you know, I'll just throw
41% drop rattle anybody.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You look at that, you're like, I've been contributing to this for the last several years, and now it's half gone. I mean,
half gone. What am I going to do? You know, we're engaged at this point. I've got a sick dog. What am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do with all this money? And then, and I moved it. I waited a little bit. And I got more scared. So yeah, 2008, I saw a 40% drop. In 2009, I saw a 17% drop. And then at that point, I got scared and I went into the F and the G fund. So I went into the fixed and the government bond fund. I was just—
Can I ask you, Greg? Yeah. It sounds like you were watching your TSP or at least monitoring it on a regular basis. And I'll compare that with, so I started contributing to the TSP in, I think, 2008, which obviously was not the greatest year for the stock market, right? But what I was a complete newbie too. So I think they just put us in, was it the G fund back then? Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, you signed up and I think I just did the minimum for the match. They put in the G fund and I just didn't even look at it for about 5 years. And to be honest, probably the G fund, it was pretty stable. And so I didn't even see all those ups and downs, but it sounds like you were monitoring and you were making moves. Do you think you would recommend doing that for people?
No. And so again, mistakes were made perhaps. I'm not ashamed of that, but so that's, if we take a look back to that time period where the federal government was, especially the Department of Defense, there had been a hiring freeze or a downturn in hiring for, you know, decade post Cold War, all of that. So what I'm getting at is the people that I was surrounded with were either completely new, like myself, or were close to retirement. And those close to retirement people, I remember at the lunch table, were scared out of their wits at the crash. So I started looking and I was like, you know, well, if they're losing all this money and they're scared, you know,
maybe I should do something
about it. And, you know, I probably had a conversation with my father and he probably, you know, say, oh, you might want to move a little bit, but don't do that much. And then I just, you know, by 2009, I was scared. I was just ready. It was like trying to save for a house. Again, I wasn't with the Foreign Service at the time, so I didn't have that kind of mentality of, you know, overseas lifestyle. We, you know, trying to save for a house, we're going to have a mortgage, talking about kids, you know, all of that stuff where it was like, you know, well, I can't pull this money out. Let me try to save it, not fully comprehending. So that was something that happened there. And just for, you know, again, you know, to murder board this, like I said, I took a look and from basically 2009, in 2010, I kind of started putting into the F&G fund. And from 2011 to about 2013, I was about 40% in the G fund. And 15% of the 15. So we're talking about a 28-year-old who, you know, basically took, you know, the exact opposite approach of what you're supposed to do. And I got real conservative. I got real nervous. And then I think that what kind of changed, it probably wasn't so much the market, but it was, I got my first overseas assignment we had been overseas in from 2009 to 2012, high post differential, high COLA. And I started making a little bit more money and the market started coming back because in that time frame, you know, in 2012, I saw about a 10% return, and we started dumping more into it. I was more comfortable. I had more promotions under my belt, and I kind of saw what the market was doing. And I said, okay, I did the opposite again, what you're supposed to do. I sold low, I bought high, but there was a turnaround there. And I took the opportunity to recognize that. And with a little bit of, again, in this foreign service lifestyle, where all of a sudden, we had bought a condo, it had been rented out, no issues. And we were overseas for at least 3 years. I said, let's see if we can make a run at this. And that's what ended up happening. And those numbers and those percentages during those 3 years really went up.
And that's the thing too. I think, like with real estate, even in the stock market, I mean, if you've got a long time frame, and again, you had just started pretty much out of college, right? I mean, and you've been in now for 18 years, which is very funny because obviously the listeners cannot see you, but I can, and you do not look like you've been in federal government for 18 years, but... But the point is that over time, you can make mistakes and still recover and still do well. And you don't need to have a finance degree. You don't need to, do these wild moves. You just need to make, good efforts, diligent steps in the right direction, at each point. And it doesn't even need to be all the time, right? Like, so simple tips like taking a piece right away to send to the TSP or to put into investing right at the beginning. And like Greg was saying, each time you get a promotion or, when you get a raise, take a little bit more and then you don't miss the money. Really easy, simple tip. I think that everybody can use.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's go back to what the other thing that you said about making a budget, because normally people hear the word, the B word, and they're like, ugh, this is a horrible thing. Like, I don't want to make a budget. And I mean, to be honest, not all of us are designed for that kind of detail. I am certainly not. Like, I would love to make a budget, but mm-hmm. Half the time, like, I don't know. So this is why I have a bookkeeper right now. But, talk to us a little bit about why a budget, I think intellectually we know that budgets work, but practically speaking, how do you actually make that work for you? And especially because, you were on one income, mm-hmm. right? And, you have children at some point, right, in this journey too. So it's not just you and your wife, but now it's your kids. How does a budget play into kind of your everyday life? And how did that, practically speaking, how did you make it work for you?
So I'll say a couple of things. I think making a budget is extremely easy. Following that budget is the hard part, right? I think we all could sit down and make a budget. It doesn't, there's formulas.
Can we? I don't know. I don't know if I could.
I think you could. So I think in general, I have faith in you, Tanya. I really do. I think
maybe I just don't want to.
Exactly. I think we can all make a budget, but sticking to it and following it. And I'll be the first one to admit, primarily the 3 or 4 times we made a budget probably in our life is at the end of a tour, right? Is when mm-hmm. it's like, oh my God, we're going back to
Washington. We're going to DC.
Income, all of a sudden these expenses. So we sit down. We make a budget. And I remember doing that when we were coming back, we needed to buy all new furniture. We needed to do all that stuff. So, we sat down, we said, okay, what do we have to play with? And we do that. It's kind of hard because you don't do that. You shouldn't be doing that at the end of your tour. You should be doing that like about a halfway through your tour. Now, because you've realized you've got the first half of your tour done, you know what your expenses are at post right now. You know what travel you have left. You know if you've got household help. You know what your school's costing and things like that. So about halfway through, take a look at what travel you want to do and what your expenses are. And then you're going back to DC. So you start taking a look either at old bills, old payments, things like that. Okay, what are my costs going to be in reality when mm-hmm. we get back? Because starting up, you go through that dichotomy of things where it's like, you want to do everything right when you get back, right? Like on this last tour, it was like, I want to get the boys in Little League. Little League starts 2 weeks after. That's a good thing to do. We know we're going to need to buy this. We're going to restock the kitchen. We're going to do stuff like that. So you have all of those things. So about midway through that tour is when you want to start looking at it. And again, you can go on any website, any budgeting website. Some people download the programs, the software. You can do Mint. You can just Google it and you can kind of set yourself up with a budget. But the problem is sticking to it when you get back. It kind of all goes out the window. And for us this time around, coming
back.
Talk
to us about that.
Yeah. So I think, sticking to some of those big, having a realistic expectation of what things are going to cost and what you're willing to sacrifice and not sacrifice. So again, for us, the thing, whether we're overseas or even now that we're domestic for some training, is the thing that's going to cost us the most usually is obviously food, and for us is travel. And now with growing boys, it's clothes. You know, I've got a 9-year-old who's wearing the same size shoes as my wife. So he's growing, you know, his sneakers. Yeah, it's insane. Those kinds of costs. But those are the things you just have to have a realistic approach to.
So actually, let me stop you there for a second, because for someone who actually is terrible at making budgets, because I am terrible at making budgets, because here's what happens when I sit down. I'm like, oh, I need to make a food budget for the month, which, by the way, I have never done, because I'm like, I have honestly no idea what I spend, right? I mean, like, restaurants, okay. I have a general idea of like, I like this restaurant. And normally when we go, it's, you know, I don't know, $60 for, you know, whatever. That I can do. Groceries, I mean, part of it probably is because my husband does all the grocery shopping. But I mean, are you, I feel like there's so many variables for me, right? And this is probably for other people that have trouble sticking to a budget as well, right? Like, how do you come up with like that cost? Are you just looking at like, well, we think it's going to be this much, or we're trying to save this much. Yeah. How did it work for you?
Credit cards. We do everything on pretty much, we use one credit card, simply kind of max out points and miles. Some are, you know, that's a whole nother podcast on things. And I am not the most expert on those, but I go back and I take a look at our credit card statements. And I take a look at what we're paying, because a lot of them now will let you categorize things. You know, it starts getting tricky. Smart. When it's like, was this Amazon purchase clothes, or was this, you know, Amazon pantry, or.
But it'll get you close to where you need to be.
And that's really what it is you can easily go back and you can either hand jam it in yourself, or you can even download, a lot of them will let you download spreadsheets now. So we keep everything on one, pretty much on one single credit card, and that makes it
a lot easier.
And then, you know, I always add in a buffer, right? And that's great, because at the end of it, you can say, look, we came in under budget. That's because I over allocated, to begin with, if you can.
Sure.
And these, at that point, you have more savings.
I'm curious if you ever look at the credit card bill and go, we spent how much on what? Like, for example, not to throw my husband under the bus, but that man loves his coffee and he does not buy cheap coffee. And not that I have actually looked at what we spend on coffee, but I have a feeling if I did that, I would be kind of shocked. So do you find that, because I think that's actually a really good tip, is to, you know, get a credit card that does break down your spending, right? Of like, I know, like, I have one credit card that like annually they'll send me a statement and they'll be like, this is how much you spent on travel and car stuff and all of this. And you can look at it and think, wow, did I really spend X on that thing? Like, and I think it's a good way of editing your finances in a way. And because for me, I like to be very intentional about my money, and I want my money to go to certain places. And when I see those kinds of things, thank you for the tip, Greg, I will actually try this now. I want my money to be going to the places I want it to go to. So if I'm spending a ton of money on something that's not important to me, I want to be able to look at that and say, hey, you know, I'm spending $500 a year on X thing, and actually that's not that important. I can use it somewhere else, right? So I think that's actually a really, really good tip of checking your credit card bill, looking at it and making sure that, you know, are you spending money in the ways that you want to? Are there ways that you can cut back? Maybe there's some places that maybe you should be spending more, because it makes you happier.
It's
right?
Always amazing. Cause like you just said, they'll put a pie chart for you. The credit cards, they'll do a pie chart for you and they'll show you, and you start seeing those percentages. And I like how you put it, you know, maybe I want to be spending more on something else, and you're surprised when you don't see it. And then what ends up happening, though, all of a sudden it's like, well, it's, you know, it's that time of the year and your renter's insurance is due or your car insurance is due, and you're trying to figure out where that extra $700 on the credit card bill is. And just another side note, the other thing you can do on a lot of your credit cards is you can set a spend notification. So you get an email every time, you know, some people do it to track fraud, you know.
Sure.
You know, if you're traveling a lot, you know, any purchase over $30, you get an email that says what it was. And so that helps. But also then set it for a higher limit, right? Because it'll tell you, you know, set it for something over, let's say $400, $300. And then you can start filing those away, and then you can start seeing what your big spends are on, right? You know, if, you know, granted, most of ours is, you know, $10 at Amazon, and then the next day it's another $12 at Amazon. And then it's, you know, things like that. Obviously those little things add up. And then, you know, you've got birthday presents for, you know, everybody. You've got, you know, happy hours, and just all that stuff starts adding up. But the more you can kind of put things in different buckets and see what you're really spending your money on, I think that helps. The other thing that helps is communication. And you kind of hit at it there a little bit when you're like, yeah, I don't really, my husband's the one who does this, and my husband's the one that does that. And for a lot of people, it's hard to talk about money. with their partner. But that's another thing is really, it's a shame because you don't, you know, the conversation you don't want to be having, and this is just in my opinion, is at the end of the month, me pulling up the statement and yelling into the other room, you know,
why did you spend on that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. How
I'm
did
laughing
you spend?
Because yeah. I've been that person.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I think we've
inevitable.
All been there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it is. It is like, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
You're like, why did we spend this on this? And yeah. Oh, yeah.
So those are the conversations that ultimately happen. But if you can find a way to have those more frequently and less intense, I think you're in a good place with your partner.
No, and that brings us into a whole nother topic of conversation, which is, you know, making this work with another person, you know, for those of us that are in relationships. And, you know, money is a sensitive thing. Everybody has their own money story and their money habits. And there's all kinds of different relationships people have with money that a lot of us don't even think about until we're adults, right? So, you know, when I was younger, I was a little girl. It was, you know, kind of very typical things. Money doesn't grow on trees. Don't waste this. You know, don't waste food. Turn off the lights. You know, there's always this scarcity. Like we have to conserve, right? And both of my parents grew up fairly poor. You know, my father was a son of missionaries, and they were basically living off tithing from the church. And my mother, you know, is from Japan, and she came over as an immigrant. And my grandparents were, I mean, they were penniless when they came here, and they worked really menial jobs and started small businesses to make it, right? So both my parents, I think, had really good, they were just very good savers because they had to be. It was a survival thing, right? The really interesting thing to talk a little bit about money stories is they passed that on to me even though I was never in their shoes. So I never, as a kid, felt like, well, tomorrow dad might lose his job and, you know, we're not going to have anything, right? I mean, we were definitely very solidly middle class. I went to private school. So did my sister. We had piano lessons, you know, things like that. But they passed a lot of those ideas and ways of dealing with money to, I think, my sister and I. And so I was always a saver. And for me, it's taken some time to learn how to spend money, strangely enough, because I always feel like, oh, if I spend it, it's going to disappear. And then, you know, it's like doomsday. Like you always have to save it because the other shoe is going to drop and the bottom is going to fall out. And I trace it back to when you're in a family where both parents have grown up, where that might happen, it gets passed to you suddenly. And it's a very weird phenomenon. And I've talked to this actually a lot of, you know, with real estate clients, because real estate, I think, especially you're buying a very large thing with probably more money than you've ever seen in your lifetime, right? It's a very stressful thing for a lot of people. And it brings up all kinds of interesting things in relationship to money. So I often find myself in very interesting sort of psychological conversations about it. And I think it's also something that you just pointed out, Greg, which is your money story might be different than your partner's money story. And, you know, kind of getting those to coexist is a whole nother thing in and of itself.
I think those are great points. And it's really made me, you know, kind of think in the last few minutes about my, you know, my money story and my parents' money story and just the influence that can have in those, you know, having those conversations, although, you know, it can be difficult, is, you know, it's necessary for your, you know, for your health. I mean, your financial health. And also kind of understanding why you make the decisions you make. And just, you know, example, both of my parents were, you know, in the insurance business for 25 plus years. So the idea of calculated risk always exists. And, you know, you've shaken your head at me in the past when I talk about increasing the level of insurance on one of my rental properties. And you're like, well, I think that's kind of high. And I sit there and I say, you know, 25 plus years of listening to my parents talk at the dinner table about these stories of what happens to somebody's house,
bad things
happen. So it's like, you know, a reserved attitude. And I think that's been the influence is, you know, calculated risk. What's, you know, what's acceptable. And you know, what are you, you know, is that gain worth that risk? You know, risk versus gain mm-hmm. is always the calculation. So, kind of getting back to, you know, the financial story on this, it's like, that's what it's always been. What's been, you know, TSP, that's a long-term investment. So risk first gain, you know, now, you know, hindsight, I can sit there and say, you know, risk first gain, I can let it ride, especially right now when we're looking at inflation, we're looking at the dips in the S&P, you know, your, you know, risk first gain, TSP is good. Okay, that's, now it's time to start looking at mutual funds or Roth IRAs, same kind of thing, life cycle funds, index funds. What's my risk first gain? If for me, I don't know enough about individual stocks and I'm going to go buy anything. And I look at those prices and it's like, I don't want to spend that on just one thing. Let me put that money in an index fund that, you know, very low fees. And you just, if Warren Buffett's telling you, then, you know, he knows a lot more than I do. And I'm just going to let that ride. And it's the same kind of thing where, you know, I can risk my money in one thing, and whether it's investing or, you know, risk my money in buying a fancier car or buying an electronic device versus putting that money away where into a 529 plan, and you see that success grow and you can pass those ideas onto your kids, talking to them about money, talking to them about saving and interest. And I think those are that's kind of the approach I've taken, whether it's been, you know, I'm new to the health savings account, but, you know, establishing Roth IRAs and establishing one for my wife, even though she's not working, but the rules let you do that. I was reading the other day at, you know, once your child hits a certain age and is working, you can set up a Roth IRA for them, and just kind of instilling those values of putting something aside for the future and watching it grow. I think it's interesting, and it's just amazing how fast that stuff can happen once you start doing it.
100%. I mean, and that is really, I think, the power in your story, which is you don't have to make these crazy moves. You can just, over time, cumulatively, in little increments, just keep adding to the pot. And it starts to snowball. It starts to exponentially increase, right? But you have to just consistently do it and consistently make those moves. Because I think the person who does it your way over time will end up with a lot more than somebody who just makes a crazy move here or there, you know, inconsistently and not very often, right? So what I really love about your story is that you didn't do anything all that earth shaking. You just did the right things over time, incrementally, as you, you know, got promoted, did all of these things. And now you're on track to be, you know, really solid, despite the fact that you've been basically living on essentially one income for a really long time, right? With, you know, certain stints where your wife is working, but really mostly it's just been you as the breadwinner, correct?
Correct. No, I mean, that really is, you know, that is what it is. And that, I think that's kind of a good synopsis of it with one tweak at the end there. What's great about, what I have found great about this approach is you're committing yourself, you know, you're putting something into a retirement fund, you can't take it out, right? You're going to get penalized. You're putting something into an HSA, you can't take it out unless you have to, right? You're going to get penalized. You've got, you know, options with a Roth IRA. You can always take out your investment. You can't take out the gains from interest and whatnot. But here's the thing is, you can stop those things at any time, right? You can, you know, if something comes up, granted, you want to have some sort of an emergency fund. I think people in our lifestyle have different levels of comfort with an emergency fund. But I think what's nice about this approach is if I need to stop investing in my Roth IRA, I stop investing in my Roth IRA and I have that money there. Now, you know, ideally that, again, that comes with some sort of planning. We're going to, you know, my son's going to want to, you know, we're going to do a sleepaway camp, or we're going to do something we want to do. We can plan for that. We have emergency funds, emergency savings for those unexpected things. But even then, you can always pull, you know, in some of those funds, you can always pull money out. And then, you know, in an emergency, if you need to do a TSP loan, you can do a TSP loan until you reorganize other things. You know, we've had conversations about a home equity line of credit, just having that cash available in order to do that. So I think that's kind of the approach, is if you realize that, yeah, I'm playing this for the long run, but at any time I can stop it. And, you know, reshift, rebalance, you know, adapt, overcome, and move forward. I think this lifestyle in general affords us those capabilities. Now, again, everyone's situation is different. As parents get older, and you need to have more flexibility on what you're able to do, if you need to take care of family, health concerns, there's always those things. There's always those excuses not to save. But
there's 100 million excuses not to do. Yes, not to save, not to do the financial moves that you need to. But again, they don't need to be big. They really don't. You just need to be consistent. So you just, you know, over time, just consistently chip away at it, right? And so I guess before we wrap up, Greg, my question for you is, what's next, right? What's next for you? Because you're kind of going up on 20 years of service pretty soon. Are you going to be in the government for a little while longer? What are you going to be doing as a TSP millionaire? I mean, you've got a whole bunch of life, you know, to live still. So what's next for you?
So the way things, you know, eventually worked out is I will be able to do that thing that we all talk about, right? You know, getting out at 50 at 20, if we want to. So for us, the way it kind of lines up, which is nice, is if, you know, we like it and we want to stay in, we stay in. And it's turned out that that's right around the time where our sons will be in college, you know, with, you know, if they decide to go to college, that's something we do try to instill in the conversations that we have, is, you know, they'll be graduating high school. And if they're looking at going on to higher education, we have, you know, we've saved for that for them. That if I wanted to retire and we wanted to be back here, we could be back here. Or at that point is when we get to do those cool, fun assignments that we didn't bid on because the schools weren't, it wasn't a family environment and the schools weren't what we wanted to be. So what's nice is I'll have that flexibility. After, you know, at the same time, I don't know what I would do with myself at 50. I don't think I couldn't not do something.
I think that makes, you know, that's all of us really, like, what do you do at retirement? That's a whole other podcast, right?
Yeah, no, so. It is. But I think, you know, we have found other, you know, other income streams, you know, not only would the pension be in play, but, you know, there's real estate. We've toyed with the idea of expanding and more into real estate, giving affording the opportunity as well for my wife to pursue her career or her interests is another opportunity. But again, it's just nice because that decision doesn't have to be made now. But if we needed to make that decision at 50, we could make that decision and just start a second life. Or if we like what we're doing and we have those opportunities, we might as well keep doing it, because it's worked out for us. So again, between the different investment vehicles that we have and the flexibility that we have, you know, one of the strategies I made, and again, this is kind of under, maybe this was a mistake, maybe it wasn't, but you know, we have a primary residence here in Virginia. And when we had historic interest rate lows, I went ahead and I refinanced from a 30 to a 15. And again, that gives us the opportunity of, you know, when our children are of college age, our house is paid off. And if we want to plant ourselves in Virginia or DC for a couple of years, we're living for free while someone else's renters have paid down the mortgage for us. So again, there's that strategy. Now, granted, from an investment portfolio, it's, you know, it's a negative cash flow at this point. We're paying more into it, but to get it down and not have payments around the time where we don't want to be having payments and possibly living in it, that was my calculated risk, was doing something like that. So yeah, I think the door is open. I think there's lots of things. But again, I don't even want to say I'm on the fence, because I'm still looking at the fence. Let me put it that way. I don't know at 50 where we're going to be or what our life's going to have, but it's just nice to have those options.
No, and I think that's the key to the whole thing, right? I mean, you made the right choices along the way and some mistakes too, and mistakes are reasonable and they happen to all of us, right? And I think it's normal. But the thing is, you made the right moves, and even with a few mistakes, you're still going to come out really well, right? And you've got a lot of options. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, you've got your house, whether you do 30-year, you know, mortgage or 15-year mortgage is really kind of a personal choice whether you want it paid down. And I mean, to be honest, for a lot of people, that's a really important thing, to have their house paid off. I mean, a lot of retirees, they don't want a mortgage anymore. I mean, my parents, I've had their house paid off for quite a while, and I keep telling them, "Oh, you could use the line of credit, you know, line of credit to buy all these properties." And they just look at me and they think, "Tanya, we have done that already." And this is not the phase of our life where we're expanding stuff. Like, we're content, we're happy. So, you know, different strokes for different folks. I think there's a lot of ways out there. And Greg, thank you for showing us that, you know, you can be just an average guy, an average investor, you know, a federal government employee, just making the right moves. And you don't have to sit there and read tons of finance magazines to do this, because just by doing the right things, taking the steps, consistency over time, you can get there. So Greg, thanks so much for being on the show. Really appreciate your story.
Thanks, Tanya.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.